This is the third in the series of lectures on the Lithuanian luminaries. It is entitled Rabbi Chaim of Brisk and is delivered at the Jewish Center on March 19th, 1967.
The Vilna Gaon, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, and down a generation or two afterwards, Reb Chaim Brisker, made of Torah studies and Torah students a Jewish aristocracy in a part of the world where it had not been so immediately before their time. And within this context, this family and this lineage of disciplehood from the Gaon to Reb Chaim Brisker and even further down was a kind of royal house. It was the Beis Harav, the house of the great Rabbonim of Litter. The Gaon student, Reb Chaim Volozhiner, as we recall from 2 weeks ago, transformed Lithuania from what was, by and large, a cultural desert to an oasis of Torah, something he accomplished both by his theoretical emphases on Talmud Torah and by his practical work in building the great Volozhiner Yeshiva. One scholar has maintained that Volozhin was not a town, Volozhin was not the name of a school, but Volozhin was a new concept in Jewish life. The dynasty, just for the purposes of those who are interested in such things, goes as follows. Reb Chaim Volozhiner, who was the founder of the yeshiva, then his son Reb Isaac, Reb Itzel Volozhiner, then after he passed away, he was succeeded by his son-in-law, Reb Eliezer Yitzchak, who had only a brief tenure because he died young. Then there came the famous controversy over the succession between his second son-in-law and Reb Yoshe Ber. On the one side, the member of the family, the Netziv being the Rosh HaTevis, the initial letters of Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and on the other side, Reb Yoshe Ber, Rabbi Joseph Ber Soloveitchik, the author of the Beis Halevi. The Netziv, incidentally, who received the position as Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, remained there longer than anyone else for about 40 years. Some of you may remember his youngest son from his second wife, Rabbi Meir Berlin, the late Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan. This controversy between them was adjudicated by a renowned Beth Din, headed by the famous Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan, which favored the Netziv. And it so happened that later the two adversaries, the Netziv and Reb Yoshe Ber, were reconciled through the subject of tonight's lecture. But more about that anon. What were the characteristics of this whole dynasty, as we have called it, of the Beis Harav? First, there was a total dedication to Torah. Total, undiminished, absolute. They lived and practiced the great statement of the Mishnah in Peah, V'talmud Torah keneged kulam, that the study of Torah takes precedence over and against everything else. Of course, you know, whenever I read this Mishnah, it reminds me of the story of the man who visited the Reformed temple, and he noticed that engraved on the legend over the entrance was the statement, V'talmud Torah keneged kulam. So he said to the rabbi of the temple, I don't understand. You really believe that V'talmud Torah keneged kulam? He said, I tell you, here we pray in English, so we read from the right to the left. We read V'kulam keneged Talmud Torah. Even within Torah, the major emphasis was on the dominance of halacha, of the strict legal studies of Torah. And the insistence was there that not a moment must be free from study. And Reb Chaim Volozhiner came across the Mishnah Novos, that Yafa Talmud Torah and Derech Eretz, that Torah is beautiful with Derech Eretz, a Mishnah which received many interpretations in the 19th century Jewish life. His interpretation was remarkable. He said that so much so must one be absorbed in the study of Torah that even during the time of Derech Eretz means business, the normal pursuits of a civilized life, even while one is making a living or going about his profession, when his mind is apparently occupied with secular matters, even then, in the deeper level of his consciousness, his mind must meditate in halacha. In other words, what he proposed is something which is extraordinarily difficult, but which can be done because it has been done. That we have to kind of split our minds and develop a double consciousness so that on an outer level of consciousness, we can deal intelligently with whatever comes to our attention. But in a deeper level of consciousness, the mind must work on matters of greater moment, such as Torah and Derech Eretz. In order to attain this, what was required was uninterrupted effort and diligence. And the key word of Volozhin, of the Beis Harav, was Amal Torah, striving, working, assiduous application to Torah. When Reb Chaim Volozhin was once asked, Vos tut men in the yeshiva? What is done in the yeshiva? He says, Me'esta mishloft. We eat and we sleep. And they said, that's what you do in the yeshiva? He said, yes. Other than learning, all we do is we eat our few meals and we sleep our few hours, nothing else. Me'esta mishloft. Otherwise, there is only Torah. This came to its climax, I dare say, in the life of the subject of tonight's lecture. That is why when we spoke of the Gaon, we had a great deal to talk about Kabbalah and about his encounter with the Hasidim. When we spoke of Reb Chaim Volozhin, we spoke about his, for want of a better English word, his theology, his hashkofe, as developed in his Nefesh HaChaim and in his attitude towards the problems of the day. But when we speak of Reb Chaim Briska, there is little to speak about controversies. There is little to speak of Kabbalah, nothing at all for that matter. We speak exclusively of halacha, of Jewish law. And to that extent, our talk will be somewhat more arcane or esoteric, perhaps a bit more difficult and a bit more demanding. When his father, Rabbi Yosher Ber, who was a great, great scholar, was Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin, there was born to him and to his wife a son, Chaim, on Purim, 1853. Even as a young child, he already had a reputation as an ilui, as a genius, and he was known as the Kleiner Rab Kiva Eger. Rab Kiva Eger was the great Gaon of the times. He was known as the small Rab Kiva Eger. Many stories are told about Rab Chaim's brilliant intellect as a youngster. Perhaps one or two of them are worth repeating. He used to study, his chavrusa, his friend in study, was one of Zalman Sender. And one day, he was about 9 years old, his father, Rabbi Yosher Ber, said to him, Chaimke, who is a better student, you or Zalman? And he was caught, so he said, I tell you, I don't know what to answer, because if I say that I'm the better student, I'm a balgaiva, I'm a show-off. If I say he's a better student, I'm a liar. So his father said, now you're both. Another story, delayed reaction. There's another story told of Reb Chaim when he was 10 years old, which again shows a mind that's beginning to become phenomenal. When his father and mother, the Rav and the Rebbetzin, were sitting in the parlor, and they both asked him to please go to the kitchen and bring for each of them a glass of tea. I almost said a cup of tea, and I reminded myself, to bring a glass of tea. And he came, and he gave the first glass to his father, and the second to his mother. So his father said to him, well, why did you do that? Why did you give to me first? And he replied, very correctly, that according to the Talmud, he chayeves bekvodcha, v'ani chayev bekvodcha, I owe you the obligation of kavod, and mother also owes you the obligation of kavod. Therefore, since you have two obligations coming to you, mother has only one coming from me. Therefore, you come before she. So his father said to him, but you forgot a Gemara. The Gemara says, I believe it's Nachum, that, and this is true for all systems of law, lahavdol, that maternity is always definite. Paternity is always a doubt. In other words, she is vadai. She is vadai your mother. She is certainly your mother. Whereas I am your father only because of a chazaka, because of a presumption. Therefore, since I am only a suffix, a doubt, and she is definite, you ought to give it to her first. A good question. So the lad thought and said, Ashen covered for the mamba vazir, give me a free of alzi, vadubis suffix, my tata. Some honor for my father, some honor for my mother, my giving her the tea first, only because you are doubtfully my father. When the Reb Chaim was 12 years old, in 1865, his father left Volozhin after the controversy to become the Rav of the Lithuanian town of Slutsk. The Netziv very much wanted the young Chaim to remain behind and continue his studies in Volozhin. Of course, he had an ulterior motive, too. The ulterior motive is he wanted this young Chaim to become the son-in-law of his granddaughter, the husband of his granddaughter. There was a shidduch involved. But the father of Reb Chaim, Reb Yosher Ber, refused. Later on, the Netziv and his son-in-law, Reb Rafael Shapiro, came traveling to Slutsk again to beseech Reb Yosher Ber to agree to the shidduch between his son, Reb Chaim, later to become Reb Chaim Briska, and the granddaughter of the Netziv. Reb Yosher Ber agreed to it. Ultimately, the young granddaughter, Lifshe, became the wife of Reb Chaim, but only on condition that Chaim remains in Slutsk with his father to continue his studies with him. During all this time, of course, the young student was growing in intellect, that which was to make him for 30 years the outstanding gaon of his generation, and also in character. He was a very friendly individual. One of the people who writes memoirs about him relates that he used to walk as a youngster with his arms around his friends in a lock of comradeship. And once the Netziv saw him with his arm around the back of another student, and he scolded him. He said, Chaim, bist du mevatel von lernen, you're disturbing him from his studies. How can he pay attention to his own studies when he has all that Torah on his back? It's too difficult for him. And the same attitude of friendliness continued later on during his rabbinate, when he would have no compunctions about letting the greatest gevirim, the wealthiest of his people, wait for hours while he spent his time speaking to the miserable and the lonely and the isolated and those who needed his friendship much more than they did. Reb Chaim was married in 1873 at the ripe old age of 20, and the story is that he received a nadan, a dowry of 1,000 rubles. He later was heard to state that he never felt as bad as during that short time when he was a gvir, when he was a rich man, he had 1,000 rubles. What he did is that his father-in-law, Reb Rafael, had to borrow a good part of that money to give him the nadan. So as soon as he got married, he paid back his father-in-law's loan, and the rest he distributed to charity. His argument was, his reasoning was, who needs money? I'm here on kest anyway. My father-in-law is supporting me. You know what kest is? Nowadays it's called a government grant. It is. There was a time in Jewish life when those of us who thought we were sophisticated and enlightened used to look askance at this terrible system of letting a young man spend his time studying when he should be making a living. Now we have Princeton Institutes for Advanced Studies and foundations and grants and scholarships and Fulbrights and Halfbrights, everything under the sun. And no one objects to us. We think it's a fine, wonderful thing, when actually it was part and parcel of Jewish life all along. After his marriage, Reb Chaim returned to Volozhin. And when his father-in-law, Reb Rafael, accepted a rabbinate in another community in 1820, Reb Chaim succeeded him as Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin. He was extremely popular. Never had there been seen such crowds attending Shiurim as during his 12-year tenure. Why? Because he was a gifted teacher, Bechesed Elyon, with a divine grace. And because he had developed, as we shall see shortly, a new derech, a new methodology in learning. He was a man whose brilliance was obvious to everyone. One particular man who survived him by many years and writes his memoirs says that he used to spend time with him in his later years at a resort area in Lithuania or Poland. And there he would be with Reb Chaim on the beach and they would work out mathematical problems on the sand, complicated problems, although Reb Chaim never had any formal training in math or any secular education. He used to challenge his students with brain twisters in an attempt to keep them, their minds well honed and sharp. For instance, let me ask you one of the questions. You know that an esrog has to be an esrog. It can't be a lemon. It has to be a kosher esrog, kosher meaning it has to be the particular species called an esrog. You also know that an esrog should be a hadar. It should be beautiful. And the beauty means it should have a certain shape, a certain form, a certain quality of or complexion, and so on and so forth. So Reb Chaim asked the following question. If I have in Sukkot two esrogim before me, one of them is an Israeli, then it wasn't Israeli, it was Palestinian, an Israeli esrog, which is definitely kosher, it definitely is an esrog, no question. But it has questionable beauty. It's not really a hadar. And I have another esrog which comes from Corfu, which is a beautiful fruit, all the qualifications of hadar, but it's a murkav. It's a result of a grafting, and it's not really, clearly, definitely an esrog. Which one do I prefer in making the bracha over esrog? The Israeli fruit, which is definitely an esrog, but of questionable hadar, or the Corfu fruit, which is beautiful, but which isn't definitely an esrog? Well, which one? Israeli, of course, that's what everyone said. And they were all wrong. His reasoning was as follows. If you should take the Israeli first, then you've already fulfilled the mitzvah immediately on a complete esrog. It isn't really a hada, but you'll fulfill your mitzvah because it's an esrog. What you later take, it can be an apple or a banana, it makes no difference, or a kofu or a real esrog. Once you have fulfilled the mitzvah for that day, it's done. So therefore, if I take the esrog first, I've missed the mitzvah of hadar. But if I take the kofu first, soma manavshach, there are two alternatives. If it is not really an esrog, I've not lost anything. I've taken it, I put it down, and I take the real esrog, the Israeli. But if it is really an esrog, so I have immediately fulfilled the double mitzvah, not only esrog, but also the hadar. This is just a tiny example of a very nice logical interpretation. Do you follow? Good, then we have a chance further. His halachic methodology, his way in learning and study of Torah, was to a large extent a return to Rishonim, a return to the earlier medieval commentators on the Talmud. Because the Rishonim dealt with more fundamental issues. They did not have before them as big and as long a history of dialectics and interpretation. So they dealt with what we might call the gut issues of the Talmudic discourse itself. They analyzed the principal problems. Rather than give his shiur, his lecture, on the Achronim, who frequently, having followed the Rishonim, were involved in many more complex issues which did not always concentrate on the fundamental problems of the Talmudic text itself. He was primarily a halachic surgeon. He had a very beautiful logical scalpel with which he was able to cut through to the heart of every issue. He had the system of breaking every problem down to a to a group of categories, what you might call a categorical analysis. Usually, the characteristic way of Reb Chaim was a halachic dichotomy, to say that the problem can be resolved by analyzing it to two dinim. In other words, what appears to you to be one common law really consists of two different ideas, shnei dinim. The two dinim idea, the bifurcation, the dichotomy, the dualism, this is characteristic almost exclusively of the derech of the way of Reb Chaim Brisker. Some examples. He will distinguish between Chefza and Gavra. Chefza means the objective problem. Gavra is subjective. Chefza means the object. Gavra means the man. In other words, this is an objective case. This is a subjective obligation. Or he will say, this is a din klali and this is a din mesuyam. This is a general law which goes all through Talmud, all through our legal structure. And this is a specific law only in this case. Or he will say, this is din and this is metzius. This is a legal construct and this is a reality, a factuality which you cannot deny. Let me give you several examples. And please try to follow. An example of Chefza and Gavra. The Talmud already knows this in a different case. The distinction between a Chefza, an objective quality, and Gavra, a subjective quality. For instance, I choose this only because it's Me'inyona Diyoma. There is a mitzvah in the Torah that Erev Pesach Tashbisu. You must destroy the chametz, beer chametz, yes? We all do that. We keep in mind to nullify our ownership, and then Pesach, Erev Pesach in the morning, we burn the chametz. The question is, how do we destroy the chametz? And about this problem, there is a controversy, a machlokus amongst the Tanoim. Rabbi Yehuda says, Ein beer chametz ela streifa, that there is only one way which we are permitted to destroy the chametz, and that is by burning it. The Chachamim, however, say, b'chol davar, you can destroy the chametz in any means you wish. You can throw it into the drain, you can beat it and pound it and throw it into the air so that it becomes dust. You can do whatever you wish to it. Any destruction is possible. What is the seichel? What is the logical analysis? The logical analysis is this, says Reb Chaim. Do we say that the law to destroy chametz is a law of chefza or of gavra? Do we say that the Torah said that this object called chametz must be pushed out of existence? Or is the Torah not so much concerned with the object as it is with me, the man, telling me that I, as an individual, must get rid of chametz? What is the difference? If the law is that I have to get rid of the chametz, it's gavra, then if I have to get rid of it, it makes no difference how. My law is to get rid of it. And therefore, if it is a gavra law, any way at all is all right. But if it is a law only on the object itself, the object must be destroyed, then the Torah qualifies how it must be destroyed. So Rabbi Yehuda, who says, Ein bi chametz ela sreifa, that the destruction is only through burning, because he maintains that the destruction of the chametz is a chefza, an objective requirement. Therefore, if it's objective, it's qualified only through burning. Whereas the Chachamim maintain it's a subjective requirement. If I am not to have it, it makes no difference how I don't have it, as long as I don't have it. And therefore, biyuro b'chol davar, however I wish. Now, through this analysis, he answers two difficult problems in the Torah and in the Rambam. Let me give you another example of how he distinguishes between two chefzes, in other words, two different qualities. And here we're going to go into a bit more detail, try to bear with me. Just in order to prevent any confusion, let me try to use a blackboard. And all those of us who have never been accustomed to learning Gemara through a blackboard, myself included, will please forgive me. There are two kinds of tefillah, two kinds of prayer. There is a tefillah called Chova, and one called Nadova, or Rishus. What does Chova mean? Obligatory. These are the prayers that we are obligated to offer up. The other is the voluntary prayers. The same thing holds true for sacrifices. We're learning Vayikra now. There are the Karbanos Chova and Karbanos Nadova. For instance, the daily sacrifice is a Karban Chova. It's an obligatory. We have to do it. The Thanksgiving offering, the Karban Toda, is a Nadova. We may bring it if we wish, if the Spirit moves us. Similarly, to pray Shacharis, let's say. Which one is that? Karban, it's a Tfilas Chova. It's an obligatory prayer. We have to daven Shacharis every morning. If I feel like davening on my own afterwards and simply offering up a prayer on my own, what is that called? That is called Nadava or Rishus. Now, what is Shacharis? A Tfilas Chova. What is Mincha? Chova. What is Mariv? No. Mariv, the Gemara decides, is Rishus or Nadava. Mariv is Rishus. In other words, it depends on whether I want to feel like praying or not. I'm just simplifying now for the sake of understanding. Shacharis and Mincha, I must daven. Mariv was, for a certain period of time, a tfilas rishus, I may, or nadav. However, in the course of time, Jews accepted Mariv and they began to pray it regularly. And so because the people themselves accepted Mariv and in fact and in effect did daven Mariv every day, it became converted to a tfilas chova. And therefore today, if you don't want to daven Mariv, you must. Same, you must daven Mariv. Now, the Rambam has the following law. The Rambam has the following law, which he just quotes from the Gemara. Mi shahaya omeid bitfila, someone was in the middle of davening, Shemona Esrei. V'nizkar shekvar hispalel, and he reminds himself, what am I doing? I just davened before. For instance, assume that I already davened Mariv and I forgot about it. No. Assume that I already davened Shacharis, but I forgot about it. So I begin to daven, and in the middle of Shemona Esrei, I remind myself, what am I doing? I davened Shacharis an hour ago. What am I supposed to do if I'm in the middle of davening? Do I complete my tefillah or not? The law is I don't. The law is posek afilu b'emtza habracha. In the middle of a bracha, I stop. And I do not continue that particular prayer. What is the reason? Because when I began this prayer, what did I have in mind? Chova or nadava? Chova. I thought I had to daven. But the moment I discovered that I had already davened, the only way to complete that prayer was in what category? Nadava. But Chova and Nadava remain two different things, and therefore they cannot combine. Because each one is a half a davening. You don't daven half a Shemoneh Esrei. You either daven a whole Shemoneh Esrei or you don't daven at all. So that since the first half was Chova, the second half is Nadava, so therefore I don't daven the second half and I stop where I am now because they cannot combine. If I want to daven Nadava, I should start from the beginning. I don't start in the middle. Then the Rambam continues. This part, up to here, the Talmud has to. Do you all follow? Because the first part I thought was obligatory. The second part I know is not, and therefore the two cannot combine. Then the Rambam says, that's true for Shacharis and Mincha. What happens if it's the middle of Mariv? In the middle of Mariv, I wake up and I say, my heavens, what am I doing? I already davened Mariv. I said Shemona Esrei. So the Rambam says, "Im hoyas tefilas arvis eino posek." There I don't interrupt, and I continue and I conclude the Shemona Esrei. Why? Shelo hispalel osa mitchila ella al dash eino chova. Because at the very beginning, when I daven Mariv, what is Mariv? It is nadava. It is nadava. It is tefilas arvis reshus. Since the very beginning was nadava, now when I concluded, it's also nadava, nadava, nadava can combine for one tefillah. Is that right? No. Why not? I just said why not. It no longer is Nadava. It's already Chova. Since we accepted it, it is Chova. That's why the Ravid, Rabbi Avraham ben David, who is the one who has the Hasagos, the glosses on the Rambam, often very sharp, has just four words to this halacha. Ein kan nachas ruach. I have no nachas from this psak. No nachas. Why not? Obviously, why not? Because since Tfilas Arvis has been accepted as Chova, it remains Chova. Marv should have the same law that Shachris and Mincha do. And if you remind yourself in the middle of the davening, then the first part should be considered Chova. The second part would be Nedava. You cannot combine them. Stop where you are and be done with it. Well, how do you answer the question? The Rambam knows that Tfilas Arvis has been accepted now. How can he possibly consider that Tfilas Arvis today remains Nedava? So the Chaim answers as follows. A tefillah which is chova and a tefillah which is nedava are two different heftzis, by which he means that they are qualitatively different. There are two different categories. One is a chova prayer and one is a nedava prayer. Therefore, shacharis and mincha are a heftza of tefillas chova, an object of chova, and mariv is an object of Nadava. Then he says, when Jews began to accept Tfilas Arvis or Mariv as obligatory, all they did was they said, I take this voluntary Heftza, this Nadava, and I will practice it as if it were obligatory, but it remains voluntary. I cannot transmute and transform the very quality and nature of a prayer merely by my practice. I can do whatever I want. I can daven Marav 10 times. But Tfilas Arvis remains Rishus, it remains Nadava. I cannot change. A leper cannot change his stripes. So according to the Rambam, Mariv remains in essence all the time a Tfilas Nadava, even if I wish personally, subjectively, to practice it every day. Therefore, when I accept it every day, I am responsible to daven Marav forever after. But the quality of the prayer remains in a davar quality. And therefore, if I reminded myself in the middle of the davening marav that I had davened already, then the first part is still considered objectively a tfilas nedava, and therefore I can complete it. But the Ravid maintains that I can transmute a basic property into another, and I can make of marav, by practice, I can make of marav a heftza, an object of Nadava, I can transform it into an object of Chav. And so he has explained that Rambam, and the question is no longer a question. Of course, this particular method of breaking down an idea into two components sometimes lends itself to abuse unless wielded by a master. The story is told that Reb Chaim was once in an inn in a hotel, and someone came to tell him that a contemporary of his, a great gadol, had used this method to probe the following problem. When a man gets married, he marries his wife with a kinyan. That's an act of acquisition, of marriage. So he said, what is this act of marriage? Does this act of marriage mean that the husband performs the act of marriage once, and thereafter they are in a static state of being married to each other? Or does it mean he performs it once and we consider as if every minute the act is being re-performed? The act of marriage is being redone throughout the rest of their lives as long as they stay married. There are certain consequences of each idea. Again, do we say, he says, that you marry once and it remains statically a state of marriage, passively? Or do we consider that the state of marriage is reenacted every moment? And in deciding the problem, this particular gadol decided that the act of marriage is reenacted every moment. So when I told it to Reb Chaim, he thought it was a little far-fetched. He said, in that case, give him a mazel tov for me. As a teacher, Reb Chaim Briska was a fantastic Baal Masbir. He had an extraordinarily lucid gift for explaining and for making himself understood. A gift, incidentally, that was not always evident in his written work. We have classically one sefer, one work by him, the Chidushei Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi, on Maimonides, on the Rambam, published by his sons posthumously. This last year, in fact, the last month, another sefer was published in Eretz Yisrael, mimeograph form, hardbound, very unfortunately, not even an introduction, nothing there. I don't know why sometimes things are done in batlonis, but that is the way it is done. An additional collection of his chidushim, of his novella, his ideas, have been published, but rather haphazardly. But this is the classical one. Most of his chidushim are in the hands of his grandchildren and his disciples and disciples' disciples, who make good use of them, of course, and giving it over from generation to generation. We are told that his oral teaching was far more fascinating than his written work, a quality which perhaps runs through the entire family. His grandson, my own teacher, Rabbi Soloveitchik, is a very gifted writer, but a far greater Rosh Yeshiva in a face-to-face encounter. He was very careful and very precise. What he didn't say was almost as important as what he did say. It was said of another great scholar of his generation that this Gaon could say the same Torah as Reb Chaim Brisker. But Reb Chaim Brisker's greatness lay in that he did not say what this Gaon did say. We are told that Reb Chaim, in his creativity, actually suffered anguish, pains, agonies of creativity. And incidentally, this idea of suffering before you make the creative performance is not peculiar to him. We have stories of others. I believe Rabbi Yaakov Baal Turim, a great medieval scholar, the son of Rabbeinu Osher, the author of one of the great codes of Jewish law, also speaks of this kind of agony. And La Havdol Elef Alfei Havdolos Ribei Ravovos Pa'amim. I believe Wagner, in the course of his creativity, also suffered a special kind of pangs. There were times that he was moody too. You know, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, our contemporary Rav, wrote a great essay, his greatest essay so far, published many years ago in Talpios. It's a classic. It's called The Ish HaHalacha, The Man of Halacha. It's a typological essay. He expresses his philosophy by describing a type, the type being the halachic man. Of course, whom does he have in mind? Reb Chaim Brisker, his grandfather. This is Reb Chaim Brisker. The Ish HaHalacha is patterned on Reb Chaim Brisker, that Reb Chaim Brisker would not have been acquainted with all the existentialist terminology, but this was his personality, this was his outlook, this was his character. Incidentally, many people do not realize that Rabbi Soloveitchik did not put his entire outlook on life into the Ish HaHalacha. There is a complimentary article that he has not yet published, but that I saw many, many years ago by the name of Ish HaElokim, the divine personality, the man of God, as the counterpart to the man of Halacha, and the one who supplements the intellectual Ish HaHalacha by the charismatic, spiritual, affective, emotional man of religion. At any rate, in the Ish HaHalacha, Rabbi Soloveitchik tells a marvelous story about Reb Chaim Brisker. He was once sitting towards dusk on the balcony. It was in a vacation resort. And someone saw him looking out towards sea, lost in thought and apparently depressed. And he said to him, "Rabbi, what's the matter?" And he saw that he is very sad and distressed. And it transpired that Reb Chaim simply was lost in moodiness because of his contemplation of death. And that he had a very distressed feeling whenever he thought about death, which incidentally is not unusual for the halachic personality, because halacha is so involved in this world of ours that death means the end of a whole halachic drama. How did Reb Chaim overcome this particular moodiness, this depression, this concern with death? Very interesting. If he felt annoyed or depressed by death, he would begin to study the Rambam Hilchas Tumas Hames, the laws dealing with death. And then getting involved in the laws dealing with death, he lost his fears, his inhibitions, his apprehensions, all of it dissipated. You see, he chanced upon a great psychological discovery here, that whenever you're caught in a situation in which you feel anguish, you feel threatened, the best way to get out of it is to treat yourself and the problem objectively. Stand apart from it. You're frightened by death, or you feel annoyed by death, or threatened by death, then treat death intellectually and pull your own personality out of the problem. Study the laws dealing with death. You know where I recently came across a similar idea? He never knew, of course, that the Reb Chaim had it much earlier. There's a great Jewish Viennese psychiatrist. He calls himself a logotherapist, Viktor Frankl. I've recommended the book to some of my friends here. A marvelous little book he's recently published. And he describes how he was in the concentration camp. I forget which one it was. I think it was Bergen-Belsen. And one day he came and he saw everything about him, and he felt shaken to his core by the mania, by the sheer insanity of the society in which he found himself. And he felt his own sanity threatened. And the only way he was able to survive, he writes, was by looking about him and imagining that he now, after the war, is lecturing to a convention of psychiatrists about the psychopathology of the inmates of a concentration camp. He objectified the situation, pulled himself out, treated it with dispassionate objectivity, and that's how he saved himself from being crushed. This is precisely what Reb Chaim did by learning the laws of Hilchas Tumas Hames. Another beautiful distinction that always recurs in Reb Chaim's works is the distinction between a general rule and a din mesuyam, a particular law. It's best illustrated by a story that Rabbi Zevin of Israel relates. He says that Reb Chaim was sitting with a group of rabbis, and in came a man crying with a complaint. A relative of his had died that day, and shortly thereafter, another man, very wealthy, died. Now, the law is, if two people die, the one who is predeceased, the one who dies first, has the rights of burial first. The one who died afterwards must await the first one, and then he goes. But the Chevra Kadisha apparently had a favoritism to the wealthier man, buried the second one first, and buried the first one second. So the relative of the poor man, the one who died first, came with a bitter complaint to the Reb Chaim, and he had tinnitus, he has a complaint. Here all the rabbis were gathered together. So Reb Chaim said, let me look it up. And Reb Chaim wasn't ashamed not to give an immediate answer. Sometimes I can get a telephone call about a problem which Reb Chaim would have spent 2 months on, and I'm expected to give an answer like that. And if I don't, of course, it means, well, you know. In fact, you should always be suspicious of people who have too many answers too quickly. So Reb Chaim said, let me look it up. And he took a Rambam down and opened it, and the other Rabbanim peered over his shoulder, and he looked, and he closed the safe, and he said to the man as follows, I will scold the Gaboim, but it's none of your business. I will chastise the Chevra Kedisha, aber es ist nicht dein Geschäft. Dir geht es nicht an. None of your business. And the man left. So the rabbis looked at each other, what's going on? They also saw what the Reb Chaim Brisker was looking up in the Rambam. They saw nothing there, absolutely nothing. And what kind of answer? If the man is right and he's going to scold the Gaboim, then it is his business. And if it isn't his business, why scold the Gaboim? And the Gaboim were right. So they asked Reb Chaim, what's going on here? He said, very simple. This law that the one who dies first is entitled to be buried first, what kind of law is this? Is this a general law that goes all through halacha, that ein ma'avirin al ha-mitzvos, which means if you have two mitzvahs to perform, the first one that comes to hand must be dealt with first, right? If you have two mitzvahs to do, which do you do first? The law is ein ma'avirin al ha-mitzvos. You don't pass up a mitzvah, one mitzvah to go to the second, no discrimination. First come, first serve. This holds true for all of Shas. So is the law that the first man to die is buried first, is this part of Ein Ma'arvin Ala Mitzvahs? Or is it a very special law that the man who dies first must be buried first because of Kvod HaMeis, the honor of the dead? So is it a general law of priority throughout the Torah? Or is it a special law here? So what did I do, says Reb Chaim? I looked up the Rambam, Hilchos Evel, the laws of mourning. And you're right, there's nothing there. The Rambam does not mention this law in Hilchos Evel. If he doesn't mention it here, what does it mean? That it is not a specific law of Kvod HaMeis, of the honor of the dead. What then is it? A general law that you mustn't pass up a mitzvah. In that case, the Gaboim made a mistake. They violated the general law of the halacha. I'll scold them. But it's none of his business, because he can't come to me complaining that he's taking up the cudgels on behalf of the honor of his relative. The honor of his relative wasn't violated. If it had been a specific law of Kvod HaMeis, of the law of the honor of the dead, this man can come to protect the honor of the dead relative. But it's not that kind of law, it's a general law. A general law, they do many averis, the Gaboim. I shouldn't, so it's not this man's particular business. I didn't mean that with any particular references. In other words, Reb Chaim Briska, instead of going to the ends of the earth for legal reasoning, went deep, directly, into the problem itself. And thus he solved problems, not by proposing very novel and complex solutions, but usually by showing that there's no problem in the first place. Now, his father, Reb Yeshu Bey, used to say as follows. He said, the difference between me and my son Chaim is this. If someone asks me a kasha, if someone comes with a tough problem to me, he is happy and I'm happy. He is happy because he asked a marvelous kasha, and I'm happy because I proposed a brilliant solution, a brilliant teretz. When I come to Chaim, the man who asks is unhappy and Chaim is unhappy. The man who asks is unhappy because he thought he had a great kasha and Chaim showed him that it's nothing. And Chaim is unhappy, he's miserable because he wasted his time on nothing. So this is the difference between Reb Chaim and other Gaonim. The Meir Berlin, if you recall, the son of the Netziv, I forget how he's related to Reb Chaim, someone could figure it out sometimes, but tells a story that there were a group of rabbis were talking, and one rabbi tried to oppose what Reb Chaim was saying by saying, there's a certain Tosfos that's against you. And Reb Chaim said immediately, there is no such Tosfos. And they checked, and there was no such Tosfos. So later, Reb Chaim told the mayor of Berlin, he says, don't think that it's my memory. I didn't remember. I don't remember all Tosfos so well that I can say this one wasn't there. That's a Gaon of Vilna was able to do this. How then? I knew logically that Tosfos couldn't say such a thing. This was the greatness of his genius. With his surgical, sharp analysis, he was able to say what Tosfos could never say. He was able to predict and divine and discern exactly what the halacha would be. In his years at Volozhin, he raised thousands of students, disciples, many of whom became world-renowned. But in 1891, the Russian government, which then was not communist but czarist, but you know, la plus échange, la plus c'est la même chose. The Russian government then too was anti-Semitic and closed down the yeshiva and officially banished the two Rashi yeshiva, the Netziv and his grandson-in-law, Reb Chaim, from the entire area. The Netziv, who was an elderly man, fled to Warsaw and there died within the year of a broken heart. Reb Chaim finally received permission to go to Brisk, where his father was rabbi. And in the year, his father, Reb Yeshu Ber, died, and Reb Chaim succeeded him. He remained the Brisker Rav for 23 years. And for 23 years, Reb Chaim complained of his own incompetence as a Rav. Despite his position as the leading Lithuanian Gadol, and therefore the inheritor, the heir of the mantle of the leadership of the Misnagdim, the opponents of the Hasidim, he was revered and even beloved, even by the Hasidim, both the small group within Brisk and the many larger groups right over the border in Poland. He was beloved by the rich and by the poor, by the zealots of the right, and even by the leftists. The Hasidim often spoke of Reb Chaim Brisk as if he were a Hasidic Rebbe who performed miracles. Once it is told that he performed a miracle, that he was going back to his home and he saw from his Bezdenstub, from the court where his Dayanim, his religious judges, the Dayanim, sat, a young girl was leaving with a chicken. She had come to ask a shayla about a chicken. He said, "Let me see that chicken." He took one look at it and said, "Go home and get the other one." And she went home and got the other one. So Hasidim said a miracle. He was able to tell immediately that there really were two chickens. You know, it was a miracle of logic, very plain, ordinary logic. He took the chicken and looked at it. He said, "What did the Dayanim say?" He said, "They said kosher." He looked, he saw there was no shayla. There was nothing even to ask about. He immediately understood there was another chicken, which he was supposed to have brought, but she exchanged them. So he said, "Go back and bring the other one before you make the whole house treif." And of course, she brought it and it was treif. But nevertheless, Reb Chaim, in turn, both appreciated and sometimes admired the achievements of the Hasidim. One Rav told that he had to visit Reb Chaim in Brisk, and he decided to go there for a Shabbos. An Erev Shabbos, he was on his way from his hotel to the Rav's home, and he passed the Karlina Hasidim Shtibel. I don't know if any of you ever are in Borough Park. There's now a Stolener Karlina Shtibel. There used to be one in Brooklyn in Williamsburg. The Stolener Karlina, their davening is fantastic. Unless you're prepared for it, well, be prepared before you go in. It's done with a great deal of it's high decibel, a great deal of verve and vitality and screaming and shouting and loud with a great deal of enthusiasm. So this Rav went in, he was taken aback by the noise, and he heard the Karlina Hasidim davening, and apparently it affected him very strongly because when he came into Reb Chaim, Reb Chaim took one look at his face and he says, "You were there?" And the man said, "Yes, I was there." And he says, "I'll tell you something. I have all the young children of Brisk have some experience with the Karlina Hasidim. It fortifies them for a whole lifetime." Sometimes I think we in our sophisticated, antiseptic, supermodern, progressive, clean, dignified orthodoxy ought to send our children for a little bit exposure to this kind of experience. It may do them good and fortify them for a lifetime. Not too much, but I'll even go for it too much, provided it's the real thing and not the shayyadokis. During his rabbinate in Brisk, he became, in effect, the leader of world Jewry, one of the great leaders. He was Derov. He was a great man of truth, a man who had the Bakoshas HaEmes. During one great rabbinic convocation in Vilna, it was decided that they were going to cable their subservient greetings to Tsar Nikolai II, Yamach Shemo, who was a great Russia, and Abchaim said, "No, if we're not supposed to, if we don't have to, then we ought not to do it. He is a Russia." They decided to do it anyway. And the Tsar, of course, never had the courtesy even to acknowledge receipt of the telegram. His MS went even further. During World War I, it was decided in that part of the world that rabbis of congregations would be exempt from the draft. Now, you know that it was no great act of patriotism, was frankly was somewhat foolish for any Jew to volunteer for the Tsar's army. And so, of course, every synagogue immediately began to get a rabbi, although they'd had none before, because they wanted to afford these rabbis' exemptions. Reb Chaim was opposed to this. He said if it were discovered, it would create a tremendous chilul Hashem. And he forbade his own son, Reb Velvula, and his son-in-law from taking such positions of rabbis of congregations, and you can be sure that they had enough learning for this, and instead sought other means of freeing them from this heinous and vile draft. Remarkably, Reb Chaim rarely paskened the shaila. He rarely acted as a decisor of law. If you asked him a question, he referred it to his dayanim. This too, in a sense, was an aspect of his bakashas ha'emes, his truthfulness. He made a clear distinction between a man who was a brilliant legal philosopher, a theoretician, and one who was a practical jurist of halacha. And because he was a man of conscience, he was afraid that he would have to follow the integrity of his own insights, and if he was going to paskin, he would have to defy authority, and that he didn't want to do. So rather than defy authority, rather than deny the truth, he simply didn't paskin. As a matter of fact, he once had a problem. Two of his dayanim had a disagreement about a get. One said the get is kosher, it's valid, the other said it's invalid. So they came to the Chaim, he took both opinions, he sent it to Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan of Kovna, the great posek, the great decisor of the age, with a request that Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan merely answer kosher or not kosher, kosher apostle, but don't give me your reasons. Why? He was afraid if Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan would give him his reasons, he would find a flaw and have to decide against him. He says, better don't give me reasons, I submit to your authority, but please, no explanations. There was only one time that Reb Chaim, not only one time, but one time preeminently, that Reb Chaim really paskened and was very strong in insistent. And that is when it came to the problem of pikuach nefesh, the danger to life. You know that we mustn't, for instance, eat on Yom Kippur or work on Shabbos, but if there is a danger to life, then certain things are permitted. Reb Chaim was very lenient when it came to such matters. And once when a student said to him, how can you be such a mako? How can you be so lenient? He said, I'm not lenient. On the contrary, I'm a machmir, I'm strict. I am strict in enforcing the commandment of the Torah that v'chai behem. Torah was made to give life and not chalila to deny life. To the critically ill, he told on Yom Kippur, you must eat and eat regularly. And eat without any compunctions about how long it takes you to eat. Now this was an astounding decision because the Shulchan Aruch tells us that if you eat on Yom Kippur because of ill health, you have to eat pachas mikashir, less than the size of an olive, over 3 minutes or 5 minutes, whatever it might be, kedei achilas pras. You have to eat very slowly. It should not be the amount that together signifies the limit of transgression. Reb Chaim said, eat as much as you want, as fast as you want. How did he go against the Shulchan Aruch? He himself never explained it. But his son, the Velvelov, blessed memory, who passed away just, how long ago was it? A couple of years ago? 2, 3, 4 years ago? The Velvelov explained it. He said the Shulchan Aruch's decision to eat slowly, pachos mikashir, less than a certain amount, is only for those who are in the category similar to me'ubedes, a woman who is pregnant, and therefore, if she will fast, she will come into a position of danger. If you have a man who is not endangered, but if he fasts, he will become misukan, then he should eat slowly. But if a man already is in sakana, he already is in a critical condition, then this law does not apply to him, and he ought to eat in a perfectly normal manner. Frequently, when he would come to a patient and tell him to eat, the patient would be gloomy and heartbroken. He has to eat a Yom Kippur Nebuch. And anyone who has had the experience knows that it's a very unpleasant thing. Everyone is fasting. It's the one time you want to fast. It hurts. So Reb Chaim would say, I don't understand why you're so unhappy. You ought to be happy. If a father has a child who was born on Shabbos and the bris is on Shabbos, you know that the bris, the milah, is a violation of the Shabbos. But the Torah permitted it. Is he sad? He's happy. It's a bris. You're not permitted to eat on Yom Kippur. But if you're sick, the Torah tells you, you shall eat on Yom Kippur. So what are you unhappy about? You ought to be as happy as the man who's performing the mitzvah of making a bris milah. Relative to this, there was a great incident, very famous, that occurred to Reb Chaim that may yet become legendary. It was in the first year of World War I, when Brisk was under Russian domination. 5 Jews were caught and accused of being spies, and they were condemned to hanging. Reb Chaim learned that for 5,000 rubles, he could save these 5 Jews. He went to his wealthy people and got nothing. War conditions were such that the economy was shaky, everyone was uncertain about the future, he simply couldn't raise the funds, and it was Erev Yom Kippur. And if he didn't raise it by nightfall, then these people would be hanged. And so he did one simple thing. He instructed the gabbai of each synagogue in Brisk that they were not to proceed with Kol Nidre until they had his permission. And as the congregants, as the Jews of Brisk gathered that year for Kol Nidre and put on their kitlin and began to prepare for the holy day, the Chaim took a large purse and went from synagogue to synagogue, chose the two or three wealthiest men, made them go back to their homes, give him how much ever he assessed them for. This he went around from synagogue to synagogue till late at night. All of Brisk kept up Kol Nidre while the Rav collected the cash. He got all the money, the 5,000 rubles. He permitted them to daven late at night, went, paid the 5,000 rubles, and the next day the five Jews were released. He was a man of great compassion. He endangered his life not only for good Jews, so-called, but there are cases that we know of when he endangered his own life to save Jewish bundes in Brisk. In the Great Fire, it seems almost every Jewish town had a story of at least one great fire. In the Great Sreifa, because of conditions then, it was more or less expected. In the Great Sreifa, the Great Fire in 1895, he showed personal heroism by his personal attention and assistance day and night. And during the time that Jews didn't have their homes to sleep in, he refused to sleep in his own bed and slept on the floor in the attic of the synagogue. He said, "I cannot sleep in my own bed as long as fellow Jews in this community do not have their own homes." His son-in-law relates that once while they were at home, a woman knocked at the door and came in bathed in tears. She was obviously pregnant, and she was pleading for help. She was destitute. And he turned to his rabbison and said, "What happened? Where is the Vaad HaNoshim?" It's a kind of sisterhood, or Noshim Nachmonius, or some group dedicated to helping people in such condition. And he saw that she whispered to her daughter, and they whispered to someone else. There was shushking. Finally, he inquired, and he discovered that this woman's husband had left her 11 months earlier. And therefore, obviously, it was the result of an immoral relationship. The response of Reb Chaim was immediate. "In Cain," he said, "it's a double rachmanis on her. It's a double pity. She will stay with us for 2 weeks in this home." She stayed there for 2 weeks, during which time she gave birth. And Reb Chaim Briska himself arranged the bris in his own home for this child of immoral act. And for 2 years thereafter, he provided for her and the child's sustenance. His home was open day and night. Beggars would use it as their headquarters. They would take the food they got and go to his home, and there they would cook for themselves. They slept there. Foundlings were left at his doorstep. In fact, some sharp merchants of Brisk, noticing all the traffic going on in his home, actually pasted advertisements for their merchandise on his walls. Reb Chaim Briska, the great Ish HaHalacha, left three distinguished sons. The oldest, Reb Moshe, of blessed memory, ultimately came to America, where he became the Rosh Yeshiva, in turn to be succeeded by his son, my own teacher, Reb Yosher Ber. May he live and be well. The second was Reb Simcha, who died probably about, I would say, 30 years ago. I remember attending his funeral in Brooklyn as a child. The third survived the longest. The Velvula, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the man who was most like him, who was known to many of us as having been the great zealot, the great Kanoi, a man of extreme brilliance, a very, very great Gaon, who succeeded his father in Brisk and then went to Jerusalem, where he departed not too long ago. When the battlefront came close to Brisk in World War I, the Chaim was afraid that he would be held hostage. So with all other Jews, he fled. He wandered, suffered privation and illness. At 63, he already looked as if he were 90. His big black eyes, which once shone and glistened like fiery coals, now lost their shine, and a sadness, a pall, came over his physiognomy. He suffered from liver trouble. In the summer of 1918, Reb Chaim Brisker passed away in a village near Warsaw. It was the year 5678, Tafresh Ayin Ches, on the Hebrew calendar. His sons, in the introduction to his Sefer, point out that 678, Tafresh Ayin Ches, numerically equals the verse, Kiva HaShemesh, for the sun had set. Indeed, the great sun of the Ish HaHalacha, the man of Halacha, had set. We have then, in our series this year, traced the great Lithuanian luminaries, the sons of Lithuania, beginning with the genius of the Gaon of Vilna, through the particular greatness of Reb Chaim Volozhiner, to Reb Chaim Brisker, whom we discussed tonight. In this period, Hasidism gave a new impetus to the development of the Jewish heart, and Lithuanian misnagdism experienced a tremendous new surge of intellectual vigor, the renaissance of the Jewish mind. By the time of Reb Chaim Brisker, the old antagonisms that we have been discussing between Hasidim and Misnagdim had been resolved, and the House of Israel was reconciled. Our generation is the fortunate heir to these two marvelous historic traditions of the Jewish intellect and the Jewish spirit. Providence has handed to us these remarkable resources wherewith to fashion our own recrudescence and renaissance of Torah Judaism, which can be one unparalleled in the chronicles of our people. It is true, Kiva HaShemesh, the sun has set. Those giants we have been discussing these past 3 years are no longer with us. You recall them, Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Ladi, Rabbi Elimelech of Lizensk, Rabbi Nachman Bratslava, the Gaon of Vilna, Rabbi Chaim Volozhiner, Rabbi Chaim Brisker. But their descendants, many of them, are worthy of their ancestors' mantles. And much more important, their teachings and their disciples' disciples are still with us. Lo Alman Yisrael, Israel, the house of Israel, is not widowed. Though the sun has set on one period of Jewish history, it is in the nature of the sun to rise once again. And rise it shall, Be'ezras Hashem, on a new period full of vitality and vigor and creativity. Or Chadash al Tzion Ta'ir v'nizkeh chulanu b'meheira li'orah.